So I just came back from teaching a retreat at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. And the theme was on nature in early Buddhist tradition and in the modern Thai forest tradition. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about what I talked about during the course of that week at Tassajara. And it was quite special to be at Tassajara to talk about nature, because Tassajara is deep in the wilderness, in Los Padres National Wilderness. There's a 14-mile dirt road. It takes about an hour up and over this high mountain and down into this narrow valley. And many years ago, when I was living there, I lived there for about three years, a man came from Holland to be a student there for a number of years. And he came into the central area, and then he took a walk to the edge of Tassajara property and was looking up the river. And he started crying. And he said he started crying because, having grown up in Holland, he had never seen any nature that had been untouched by humans before. And it was such an awesome thing for him to see. So Tassajara is this place that's surrounded by kind of wilderness, untouched. And it was a place that I practiced for many years, and the context of being there in the wilderness was very important for me in many ways. Spent a lot of time hiking up in the mountains or along the river. And I was always aware, kind of being there in the monastery, you're always aware of the nature around you. And it was also important in my relationship to Zen practice or Buddhist practice. We would in many ways, but one way I'm thinking of now is that we would spend a lot of time in the Zendo, in the meditation hall. We would eat in there, we would meditate in there, we have Dharma talks in there. And we did a lot of chanting in there, a lot of bowing in there. And morning service, noon service, afternoon service. And, you know, it had a certain aura, a certain mystique and power of Zen practice. You have a group of maybe somewhere between, somewhere between 30 and 50 Zen students who are all dressed in black robes, and you know, it's quite an impressive atmosphere. And sometimes I'd stand there, kind of doing this chanting, the services, and bowing. And I'd imagine what it'd be like if we took away all the buildings and all the altars and all the Buddhas, and we were left there in the middle of the wilderness at Tassajara, bowing and chanting, and it kind of took gave me a very different context of what we were doing, and I kind of helped free me a little bit from the aura of religiosity, aura of kind of collective practice that was going on there. And it was very refreshing to have that kind of image and imagination. And then I could throw myself back in with a kind of different spirit, kind of enjoying what I was doing. So Tassajara, being in the wilderness. So Tassajara is a practice place. It's a place where people go to engage in very serious Buddhist practice. Some people go there for many, many years. Some people go for 3 months of intensive practice during anywhere between September and May, April. And so there's a juxtaposition at Tassajara of this very serious, very intense practice. Some of the people there are being trained in order to become, to make Buddhist practice their life, you know, becoming priests and monks and nuns. So you have the juxtaposition of this very serious practice happening, and you have the wilderness. And when you look at Buddhism and Buddhism's relationship to nature, you're always going to find that juxtaposition of the relationship of practice to nature and nature to practice, almost always. You're never going to find the idea of practicing, spiritual practice, very far from what Buddhists talk about nature. At least in the early tradition and in the Thai forest tradition. And one of the places maybe to begin in talking about the tradition is to understand that the early Buddhist tradition, much of Buddhist tradition, talks about Buddhist practice as a path. And the word that's used in Pali is magga. In Sanskrit, it's marga. And the word we have for religion in the West is a word which is foreign to most other non-Western cultures. And many non-Western cultures had to kind of invent a word or figure out a word or scratch their head. What do they mean, this word religion? It's so obvious to us what it means, right? But, you know, what in the world are these people thinking about the religion? And so the Japanese invented a word, because in order to make that fit. And perhaps Buddhism shouldn't be considered a religion. Maybe it should. It depends. Buddhism doesn't care that much what it's, you know, whether you know it has that label or not. You go to the old Soviet Union, and Buddhism was clearly not a religion, because Marx was not. Marx and religion didn't go together so well. So Buddhism is not a religion. Come to the United States, and it's definitely a religion because you get a non-profit tax status. It's very happy. So Buddhism is very flexible, adaptable. It's other people's labels. So, but the label that Buddhism has for that's kind of comparable to a little bit to religion, but maybe not so close, is and the way it was classified in India was it was a marga. It was a magga, it was a path. And there were other spiritual traditions in India that offered margas. Some of you remember Ananda Marga tradition that was quite popular for a while in the 70s. They still have a center in Los Altos. And so it's offered a marga, a path. And in talking about the path, the Buddha gave an analogy. He said that the analogy was that of a person who went into the forest and found a path, a road in the forest that long ago had been overgrown. And there were just little hints and traces that this path was there. But the path was there. It used to be a road that was quite clear to follow. And he was able to track and follow those hints of the road and follow that road into the forest until it came to a big abandoned city. Maybe you imagine going down to Central America and going to the jungles and finding these big Mayan cities. And so you go into the jungle and follow this path and you came to this big ancient city. And then that person then came back, left the forest, and went to talk to the monarch of the realm and said to the monarch, look, there's this beautiful, there's this path there, the road that goes into the forest, and it takes you to this great ancient city that's been abandoned, it's there, ready to be reclaimed. And so the king comes and walks the road, clears the road, and sure enough they find this great city and it gets repopulated. And the Buddha says, that's kind of like what I've done. I have discovered an ancient path, a path that's always been there. I didn't invent the path, but it's always been there, but it's been long overgrown, very hard to find. And I kind of went and was able to find those little hints in the forest and find that path, and lo and behold, it led to this great city. And the great city for the Buddha was the experience of nirvana, the experience of freedom, of liberation. And so it was, this is what I found, this ancient path, and I took it to the city of nirvana. And then by using the analogy, the person he's telling this to in the story is the king, but now he's telling it to us. So each of us is the monarch. And I love this, that royalty, the king or the queen, that somehow there's some kind of, speaking to some kind of profound dignity or royalty or strength in each of us. That's the part the Buddha was speaking to when he said, look, I found this path and this road in the forest. And as a royalty, as someone with some, whatever that means for you, let's go reclaim that ancient pathway in the forest. Let's find that ancient city of nirvana. So it's a nice analogy. It goes a little bit further in that the Buddha, in the first instructions that he gives, in a number of places when he gives meditation instructions, just about the first, if not the first instruction he gives, the one piece of instruction that's most often overlooked when people like me give meditation instructions, we don't use this, say this, and we leave this out. The first instruction is, go and sit at the foot of a tree. That's where you do your meditation practice. Go sit at the foot of a tree. There's a quote where the Buddha says, if the monastics go and practice in the wilderness, in the forest. Then the way of the awakened ones will not decline. So that's a pretty powerful statement about the importance of practicing in the wilderness, in the forest. Someone needs to be in the forest, and so that the way of the awakened ones doesn't decline, so the whole path of practice doesn't get overgrown again. Another point or place we see it, in the first instructions to a new monastic is go practice in the forest, go practice in the wilderness. And then there's a whole bunch of other kind of instructions that they're given. But the first one is go practice in the forest, in the wilderness. The Buddha himself spent a lot of time in the forests, in the woods. It's said that the Buddha was born under a tree. He was enlightened under a tree. His first sermon was given under a tree. And he died under two trees. This is where he spent much of his life. Trees were a big part of what Buddhism occurred in ancient India, was under trees, with trees, in the woods, in the forests. When it was time for the Buddha to teach his son became a monk. Or first he was, you can't become a monk when you're too young, but when you're young you become a novice monk. So his son became a novice monk at a fairly young age. And so he probably spent some time with his father because, you know. And at some point, the Buddha felt that his son was ready to hear the Dharma, to have some really, was ready for some real deep opening in the Dharma. And so what the Buddha did was he took his son deep into the woods and sat him on a log, they had these big, they had huge roots, you know, these big banyan trees and stuff. And he sat him on the root, and he gave him a discourse that kind of opened the Dharma eye of his son. So the wilderness then, the forest, becomes a place of practice. There's a very interesting story of one person's encounter with a bunch of monks practicing in the forest. It was a story of a king who probably had a guilty conscience. And this king decided he couldn't sleep one night, and he'd heard this full moon night that the Buddha was residing in a forest nearby with a large gathering of monastics. And he thought he'd go that night and have a Dharma conversation, talk to the Buddha, have a spiritual conversation with the Buddha. And so he first got his armies together, and you know, he doesn't go without it, usually his army, I guess, and his chariots, and he went to the edge of the woods. But you don't go into the woods where an enlightened person is with all your arms and soldiers. So he left them all behind, went in disarmed, and went in just with his minister to know the way. And it was dark. They were going into this dark wood, and he knew that there were a large gathering of monks around the Buddha. And as the king goes into the woods, it's really quiet. It's so quiet that he gets spooked. And he turns to his minister and says, the description in the suttas is his hair stands up on end. And he asks his minister, is this an ambush? He led me into an ambush. And I guess the minister says no. And there in the distance, they see a little light, and they walk through the light. And it turns out that this large gathering of monastics, they're all sitting in meditation. And in the woods, and that meditation, you know, they're all. The king couldn't believe you could have such a large gathering of people sitting in silence. He thought it'd be lots of noise. That's why he was spooked by it all. But they're all sitting in profound stillness in the woods, late into the night. An image of what the old forest monks a little bit were like. There's nature poetry from the early Buddhist tradition. So, mostly written by some of the monks and nuns who were disciples of the Buddha. As it's translated into English, it doesn't seem to make great poetry, but it might well be some of the earliest, if not the earliest, kind of nature poetry in human history. So it's kind of interesting. And some of it is talking about the delight of being in the wilderness, being in these rocky crags where there are deer and monkeys and wild boar roaming around. Elephants are, you know, I don't know, what kind of sound do elephants make? They resound, they bellow, they trumpet, trumpeting elephants. And they talk about, you know, the beautiful wet moss-covered rocks. They talk about the trees that are full of flowers and the ground which is carpeted with wildflowers. They're beautiful places. And they talk about how their heart is delighted in these places of nature. And it's talked about how place being in nature is a place to uplift the heart, to inspire the heart. And many of us, you probably had that kind of experience of being out in nature in the wilderness and being inspired, being uplifted. A lot of our worries that we have in normal life kind of can fall away. A lot of our perspectives and values that we have in sometimes urban, busy life get changed radically when we go into the wilderness. A lot of things which have important meaning here have absolutely no meaning in the wilderness. If you have a PhD in Buddhist studies and you go tell that to a tree in the forest, the tree's not going to be impressed. You know, if you're by yourself, no one's there to kind of, wow, you know, that's something. It doesn't mean anything. And so you just left, you know, a lot of things that we kind of built, you know, you put on the best possible clothes or you wave your bank account, you know. And you know, there's no one there to notice and take, you know, it doesn't mean much. And in some ways, the forest, the wilderness, is sometimes a great equalizer for people. People who go into the wilderness as in groups will often find that their relationships become equalized and a lot of the social stratification that can happen outside falls apart in the wilderness. I remember many years ago reading a story about a young woman. I guess she was writing a story, but when she was a young girl, she, I don't know how old she was, but 7, 8, 9 years old. And she got a haircut that was awful. Kind of cut it really short and just was not a very good job. But you can't really redo it when it's really short, you know. And it was before shaved heads for people was more stylish. And she was devastated by, you know, what had happened to her. And when her father came home and saw what happened, he said, come with me. And they got in the car and they drove out of the city into the wilderness to some place, I don't exactly remember where, but I imagine it's kind of like edge of some great big mountain vista or some place in the wilderness. And the father said, you know, these mountains don't care about your hair. And that, she said, freed her, kind of loosened her up from this kind of, you know, way she was kind of caught by her haircut. So the wilderness can change our perspective, can inspire us with beauty. The wilderness can be a place that's still, tranquil or quiet in many ways. Someone once said, a forest is a tranquil place, but it's not a quiet place. Sometimes there's a lot of animal sounds and sounds, but it's a tranquil place. And that tranquility, that peacefulness is very helpful for meditation practice. You don't get distracted by a lot of things. So it's very easy to see, you know, how it's a great place to meditate. But Buddhist spiritual life is much more than meditation, much more about getting peaceful and calm. There's also a very important aspect of it of developing ourselves, developing our character, developing our strengths. And the two kind of need to go together. To just become peaceful, just become empty, without also developing some inner strength, sometimes ends up to be kind of a lopsided person, lopsided kind of psyche. So going into the wilderness requires a lot of us. It requires a change of attitude. It requires a change of behavior often. A lot of things, you need to develop a lot of skills in order to live in the wilderness by yourself. One of the first things I think about the wilderness is that it's a place where you need to travel light. You don't carry a lot of your baggage with you in the wilderness. So you have to learn how to travel light, both physically, but also psychologically. You have to let go of a lot of the kind of extra baggage we have in our minds, extra concerns, preoccupations, so we can really be present. Earlier this year, I went backpacking by myself for 5 days. And I was the first person, I think, in the backcountry up in Emerald Immigrant Wilderness. And it was seductively park-like. You know, it seemed very peaceful and relaxing and beautiful. And the first days was kind of like just, it seemed so innocent or so beautiful, so pastoral or romantic. And, you know, everything was fine and harmonious and there were deer, and, you know. And but you know, the further away you go, if you're by yourself, you know, there's no one to help you if you slip or something happens. And when I got to the as far in as I was going to go, then I noticed that it looked like it might rain. And I'd crossed several deep rivers in order to get that far. And so I better get back across these rivers before they swell. And so I started hiking back. But I thought that the route I had planned to go back was at a lower elevation than I had gone in. But I hadn't anticipated that it was the north side of the slope. And so there were huge snow fields still there. And the trail couldn't be found. And some places it just was impassable, and I had to go around the mountain one point. And because the trails were so wet with streams of water, often the trails couldn't be were confused trails with these running streams that kind of ran off the trails. It looked like trails to me. And I found that last full day that I was hiking in there, I tried to hike out as far as I could. I hiked for about 13 hours. Every moment was a question of tracking. I had to be really present. I couldn't let my mind wander and think about my life or whatever. I had to be there for every moment. Every moment was consequential. I had to be present and kind of figuring out where the next step was going to be, where the trail was, where it was not, where it might be, backtrack, where was I, go back to where I last saw the trail and find it. And I felt 13 hours of this kind of very intense mindfulness practice. I had to be present, 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 present. And after about halfway through the day, I realized what I was doing, and I was kind of amazed at the degree of presence, because it was consequential. And you come to these rivers, and you have to kind of consequential how you cross the rivers, and you have to be very careful. But you know, I promised my wife to be careful. And you know, they were up to my waist. At one point, I had to cross a lake, and the trail—I couldn't believe it—went right through a lake. I mean. The lake was kind of clear, so you can kind of see the trail. And later in the season, I guess the lake wasn't so big. So I walked through the lake. It was up to my waist. And the wilderness sometimes is a place of hardship. And for all the kind of idyllic descriptions of being in the wilderness, there's lots of unidyllic descriptions of it, especially if you go to places more tropical, India or Thailand. The litany of interesting insects you have to contend with, not to mention the leeches and scorpions and spiders, and you know, and then there's the cobras and the snakes, and then there's the tigers, and there is the mountain lions around here. One of our reverend or venerated local Vipassana teachers was in the wilderness this spring in Santa Cruz Mountains and was roared at by mountain lion. Basically, mountain lion was saying, she never saw it, but it roared plenty. She just froze and she didn't even say, where is it? She stood up against a tree trying to figure out, where is it? And it took her a while to realize that the mountain lion wanted her to get away. So she went back where she came from, and then further went, the less the roars. But she said it was terrifying to have them. I've heard a lion roar once, but probably a mountain lion similar. So it happens right here. And there's a lot of stories in the forest tradition in Buddhism of people practicing with tigers, rhinoceroses, elephants, and the other kind of things that occur in the forest. And it's considered part of the training to contend with that those kinds of encounters. So rather than being a distraction from practice, it's what allows the mind to become strong. And you have to, in order to survive, you have to kind of, it's only you and the wildlife. You know, it's not like you can't, and monastics, when they go in the forest, they don't have guns, they don't have weapons. So it's really up to you and your own minds, the state of your mind, the skills of your mind, the abilities you have, to contend with the dangers in nature. Some of the forest monks talk about getting sick deep in the forest. And they might know a little bit about herbal medicines of the forest, but mostly if the herbal medicines don't help, then they're really left there to practice with their illness and to use their power of their mind to somehow contend with the illness, to help cleanse themselves or to help stay relaxed or somehow to very deeply penetrate the nature of suffering while they're deeply sick. And I've had friends who've been practicing in the forests of Thailand who had to deal with malaria as part of the forest practice. I don't recommend that you go into the forest of Thailand and get malaria. But you get a sense from these kinds of stories of what that practicing in the forest is not just an idyllic place. It requires a lot. It requires a lot of character building, a lot of renunciation, a lot of letting go. And it's not like practice, you know, in comparison to some of these forest practices that going to Spirit Rock is like going to the Hilton. You know, you know, it's the biggest danger you have to worry about there is, you know, well, there are mountain lions, I guess, but, you know, it's pretty safe there. The other thing that the tradition talks about, the value of the forest, is that the forest teaches the Dharma. Nature is a place to teach Dharma. One of the founder of the modern Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Mun, says that when he was first ordained, his teacher took him into the forest so he can learn the Dharma from the trees and the rivers and the flowers and the animals. That those are teaching the Dharma, so they're speaking the Dharma to you. And there's a lot of Dharma to be found in the wilderness. Sometimes some monks talk about encountering death in the forest, dying animals or dead animals, and then having to kind of contend with that and find the Dharma in there. Seeing impermanence in nature. Seeing impermanence in nature and then seeing that same impermanence reflected in oneself. See that, one's own body and internal life. And to see that one's inner life, one's own physical and psychological life is very similar, the same, as the life of nature around us. One of the great forest monks of Thailand who died a few years ago was Ajahn Buddhadasa. And he had a forest monastery in southern Thailand. And his instruction for when he died was take my body and prop it up against a tree in the forest and just let it decay there. Partly so the monks can just see the natural process, how it works. And because he was so famous, he didn't get his wish. I think the king and everybody got involved and he got a big royal funeral. But the connection to nature is more intimate in Buddhism than simply we can learn from nature or get Dharma principles from nature. In the classic teachings of Buddhism, there's such an intimate relationship between nature and the human mind that it's hard to separate them. That they're in such close relationship to each other, and the cause and effect relationship between them is so intimate that probably doesn't make sense to have a sharp divide between the human world and the natural world, or between the self here and nature out there. And I think that often when Westerners have a strong divide, they misunderstand some of the Buddhist texts where they don't. That's not the worldview that existed 2,500 years ago, the sharp divide. It was more actually kind of a mutuality, an interdependence, an interaction, a cooperative. One teacher talks that nature and humans are cooperative. All life is a cooperative that works together. And we find ancient myths in Buddhism, going back to the Buddha, that the state of human mind has a direct impact on nature around us, on the environment. The more defiled the human mind is, the more the human mind is filled with greed, hate, and delusion, the worse and worse the environment around us gets. And there's these myths that talk about how terrible it gets. It just gets worse and worse and worse. We're actually in the upswing right now, according to the myth. Things have gotten a lot better than what they were like. It got so bad at some point where people's lifespan was only 7 days long. And just all these awful things were going on. And when things got really bad in these myths, when things got as bad as they get, the way that society was renewed was someone decided to go into the forest and practice and start living an ethical life first. And as people started living an ethical life and started practicing a spiritual life, then the environment, the nature, everything kind of started changing for the better again. And so that's kind of a myth. But that myth, you don't have to go very far to see how it's very true in many, many centuries, many times in human history, where human greed and aversion has created tremendous devastation around it. You know, it's really changed the environment dramatically in ways that have been very detrimental for everyone. So the state of the human mind and the state of the environment is so closely connected. And so part of taking responsibility for nature is also taking responsibility for ourselves and for our own mind, our own hearts, and the quality of it, the state of it. So it then can help support the nature around us. If we don't see that relationship between the human heart, our hearts, and the world around us, then it's maybe only other people's problems of the environment. The connection to nature is even deeper than this in the tradition. You have quotes by some of these forest monks. Concerning the Dharma. The Dharma is the teaching, the Buddha's teachings, the teachings of truth, the teachings of realization. The Dharma is also the practices and the realizations that come from spiritual practice and the Buddhist practice. The Dharma is also understood as some of the patterns and laws that are inherent in human life and human nature. The Dharma is, you know, what we take refuge in Buddhism. We take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. Dharma is really a central element to the whole Buddhist, strong symbol, strong, has tremendous meaning in Buddhism. And here is Ajahn Chah. He says, whether a tree, a mountain, or an animal, it's all Dharma. Everything is Dharma. Where is the Dharma? Speaking simply, that which is not Dharma doesn't exist. Dharma is nature. If one sees nature, one sees Dharma. If one sees Dharma, one sees nature. Seeing nature, one knows the Dharma. Buddhadasa says, the entire cosmos is a cooperative. The sun, the moon, and the stars live together as a cooperative. The same is true for humans and animals, trees and the earth. Our bodily parts function as a cooperative. Whether we realize that the world is a mutual, interdependent, cooperative enterprise, when we realize that the world is a mutual, interdependent, cooperative enterprise, that human beings are all mutual friends in the process of birth, old age, suffering, and death, then we can build a noble, even a heavenly environment. If our lives are not based on this truth, then we'll all perish. Dharma, the Buddhist word for truth and the teachings, is also the word for nature. That is because they are the same. Nature is the manifestation of truth and the teachings. When we destroy nature, we destroy the truth and the teachings. When we protect nature, we protect the truth and the teachings. When I taught this workshop at Tassajara, one of the things I didn't anticipate is that the participant in the workshop, we're going to be surprised that there is still a forest tradition in Buddhism. That there's a monastic forest tradition, people who still, to this, they thought it was something that existed long ago. But there are still people who choose to live their practice in the forest. And many of them become monks or nuns. And they go off where there's still forests left. In Thailand, there's very few left. 50, 60 years ago, there were a lot. Now there's very little left. Now, it's these forest monks who are really some of the main people preserving the forest in Thailand, and their presence is kind of protecting it. But there are people who live this life. There are people here in California who live the forest monastic life. And their forests are oak, chaparral, poison oak, woodland, and with bears and mountain lions up in Ukiah. So these people at the workshop were quite surprised and inspired that this still existed. And there was some discussion about how useful it would be in the United States to have a forest tradition really well established here, because it would show a different relationship people can have to nature, another function of nature, of the environment. People who go into the wilderness and to some degree live in harmony with the wilderness are not there to exploit it, but rather to live there in a very kind of nonviolent, simple way. And two people, one person who had land asked me, what would it take for me to donate this land for it to be a forest monastery? I thought it was great. Wow. And so I told him all these things. I gave him addresses of forest monks and how he should go about looking into it. And maybe he could find a group of forest monks to come to his state instead of a forest monastery. Part of the function of forest monks is to be, in some sense, show a radical alternative way of living a life. And I'll end with one more quote from one of these forest monks. "The lives of forest monks and nuns and the pattern of relationships in the monastic community convey to people in the larger society certain messages, some of which deny or resist the prevailing values. Such messages point to the true value of life, indicating that development of inwardness is much more important than wealth and power, that the life of tranquility and material simplicity is more rewarding and fulfilling. Such messages provide both hints and warnings, which enable people to stop and reflect upon their lives, leading them to seek themselves rather than material gain and glory. Such messages are especially revolutionary for society blindly obsessed by impoverished values. To have forest monasteries amidst, or to put it more correctly, elevated above the lay society, is to have communities of resistance that, by their nature and very existence, question the validity of popular values." So is America ready for that? So those are my thoughts. And it's kind of a rough summary of what I taught last week at the Sahara. And we have a couple of minutes if anybody would like to make any comments or questions. Yes, please. That sounds familiar. Beautiful. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and putting one breath next to the other over and over again until finally some of them stick together. And then make a beautiful pattern. Yeah, it sounds like monastic life. Yes.
I think maybe a couple of years ago you were talking about Gatindang for several weeks. And one of the things that you said that really stayed with me was that here in San Mateo County, if you have a certificate of death and you live here, then you can bear that person on your own property. So it occurs to me that perhaps it also means that you could have a forest style way of having your body laid by if you had enough property that nobody was.
So the question is, since in San Mateo County people have the right to bury their dead on their own property, you need to get a permit for that. And if you sell the property, I don't know exactly what happens then, but you can get a permit. And so maybe in San Mateo County we could do the same thing. You know, some of us when we die, we just kind of we go into the woods there and prop ourselves up against a tree. And I don't think that you can get a permit for that. I think there's probably sanitation and health kind of concerns around open corpses in San Mateo County. So I hope that that was interesting. And oh, yes.
I have tried meditating outside, and it is so distracting with the buzz calling all the time.
Yes. And so a few things. The monks in Thailand have something called a gork, which is a big umbrella that they hang from a tree, and then has mosquito netting draped along the sides. So they sit in with the mosquito netting. So that helps a little bit with the insects, but not completely. And but that's part of the value of being in the forest, is that it requires us to muster a greater level of strength and commitment and letting go than meditating in some place that's really comfortable. And you know, if it's just about becoming peaceful, then maybe we're better being in the perfectly air-conditioned, beautifully quiet kind of, you know, place. But the point is not just to be peaceful. The point is also to be able to challenge the mind in some of the deepest places the mind is challenged, where the mind holds on and clings to what it thinks is really important. And clinging to comfort is one of the great graspings that people have. And learning how to have uncomfortable situations and have the mind be stronger than the discomfort, so the mind stays peaceful, is part of the spiritual cultivation of Buddhism. So you don't want to just be relaxed. You want to have the mind strong enough so it can be balanced in any circumstance at all. If Buddhism is about freedom, and you can only be free when things are comfortable, that's not really freedom. So part of the value of going into places where it's cold or difficult is to contend with those. And there's many stories of people who practiced in the cold or practiced with insects or whatever, and then relied on the strength of their own mind. I'll end with one more little story from the ancient suttas of a person, monk or nun, I'm not sure which, who is practicing in the forest and it's cold. And Mara comes along. Mara can be understood as kind of the personification of inner forces of doubt and different things. And Mara says, it's too cold here. You should leave the forest and go find some comfortable house or place to go meditate and lock the door there. And the monk says, oh no, I don't need to. I rely on the power of my meditation on loving kindness to overcome the cold. So you're developing a very strong concentration to deal with the cold. And so that's a kind of a development of oneself. Not for everyone, but it is for some people. One little quick little thing, then we can stop. There was a monk in the time of the Buddha who asked the Buddha to go, if he could go into the forest to practice. He found a beautiful place to practice. And the Buddha said, no, this is not the time. And the monk asked three times. And when you ask a Buddha three times, the Buddha has to say yes. He went into the woods to practice. And he came back a few days later and said, it's amazing. All the conditions there were just right. There was a beautiful forest place. The temperature was right. There weren't so many insects or whatever. And I sat down to meditate. And I just couldn't get my mind concentrated. And the Buddha said, yeah, you weren't ready to go in the forest. So, you know, there's also preparation for that part of practice too. So maybe someday we'll have a forest place up in the foothills here, and we can go up there and practice. So thank you all very much.